This is Eco Radio KC, a locally produced exploration of positive solutions to the ecological challenges we face as we work to create a healthier future for our community and the planet.
Good evening and welcome to Eco Radio KC here on 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio. My name is Mike Murphy. On tonight's program, we have Craig Lubo and Craig Volland discussing CAFOs. What are CAFOs? You'll have to stay tuned to find out. But also, we've just got one news item, and I've got a clip earlier today. Your humble reporter was out at two weapons plants here in the Kansas City area. First, the old weapons plant known as Bendix, as Allied Signal, Honeywell, and many other things. That's at the Bannister Federal Complex there, out on Bannister Road. That weapons complex was closed and relocated to a new facility 8 miles south a few years back. So there's been this tradition on Memorial Day to actually march from the old weapons plant to the new weapons plant. This was the first year where that full march did not occur, but people drove. So at the first weapons plant, there were about 25 people or so gathered, and Maurice Copeland spoke, former plant employee there. We'll hear from Maurice, and then we'll wrap up coming out of this clip. Again, this is Henry Stover first speaking, and then you'll hear Maurice.
And thank you, all of you, for being here. Because originally some station, media station, we said, oh, maybe 10 or 15 would be here at this first point. Many more will be at the other end. But we've got a great gathering here. And Maurice, you are on, Maurice.
Okay. Hey. You can turn that camera on, but I know you're not going to put what I have to say on the TV, especially Channel 41. Russ Potosik, there used to be a reporter out here that was reporting on this bad stuff that's going on out here. He has borreliosis.
Oh, my God.
Now, I want people to understand that man only reported on what was going on out here. He was the investigator, and he was contaminated by the elements at this plant. So that means that anyone can be contaminated. If Maurice Copeland stood up here and lit a cigarette, somebody would be offended because of secondhand contamination. You have 70 years of secondhand contamination right here at this plant of people that sleep with you as your husbands, that you don't know what they did here. You have no idea because we're under national security. I am not a happy camper. I'm not a happy camper because our government, the unscrupulous government that we have, has led the people astray and kept these issues covered up. We know for a fact we advocated for investigations at this plant. The United States government came in, sent the IG, sent the CDC, sent the EPA, sent everybody in here to investigate. What was investigated here about the contamination and the sickness of the workers was GSA. Now, I don't know if people get that, but why would you investigate GSA? GSA is not the source of the contamination. The source of the contamination is DOE.
Yes.
But we were led astray and have been led astray, and no one has said anything about that for over 10 years. Over 10 years, your leadership in the city, in the state, and in the federal government have failed you. They take you for suckers, and that's exactly what we are.
That's right. Yes.
That is exactly what we are. And as long as we keep doing this, well, they're going to do it to us. You have got a situation right now that people ought to be reading between the lines. Korea wants a nuclear weapon. They have one, maybe. They say that they've got problems. The other day, they come back and say, we don't want it. Remember? Y'all know? We don't want them. Why don't they want nuclear weapons? They don't want nuclear weapons because now they know that where they're testing these weapons, where they're building these weapons, those people are contaminated. Oh, how long did it take them to find that out? They've been developing their weapons a very short time. We have been developing our weapons, not only developing them, we dropped a couple of them for 70 years. So when you know that your ancestors, your parents, your grandparents died at 52 years old and they worked within this vicinity, well, I want you to be mad about it. Now, like I said, I'm not in a good mood. And I know, Jane, and don't want me to take much time. I'm going to stop here. And I want you people to start thinking. And I want you to get mad. And I want you to confront.
Yes.
Confront your leadership.
That's right.
Confront them.
Vote for new ones.
You can walk. You can go down into the plant, almost into the plant, by going down that street there. And you will see the process of cleanup. You will see the people cleaning this. It's an atomic energy landfill. Everybody knows it. You might not know it, but everybody knows it. It's an atomic energy landfill out there that has been operating since 1949. What would we put in an atomic energy landfill? They're cleaning that up currently. None of the guys that work there, I got them on film. None of the guys that work there is wearing any respiratory protection. No big thing. We had 70 years worth of people that worked out here in this stuff that had no respiratory protection. So these guys, let them go. Let them go because they've been told. They have, not only have they been told, they are being told what to do and how to do it by people that do not care about anything that happens to them but getting the job done. That's it. Getting their little money.
Yeah.
And
right.
That you ought to see, and I'm getting ready to go. They estimated the cleanup, I'm talking about your federal government, estimated the cleanup of this plant at over $800 million back in 1989. Well, the job you're getting, that you're going to be living with, that you little young people out here ain't going to know nothing about when you raise your kids and they build an apartment complex over here, you're going to bring them over here and they're going to live. They're going to swing in Legacy Park. You're not going to know anything about it. They're not going to know anything about it. The job that you're getting is a $200 million job. Is that cleanup?
No.
No. Let's get real and stop messing around.
Thank you.
It's a cover-up.
Thank you, Maurice. Just remember, Margaret Mead many years ago said, it's just a small group of persons that have brought about great changes. And Miles, would you come forward?
And that was Henry Stover and Maurice Copeland. Maurice, a former plant employee there at the Bannister Weapons Plant that was recorded earlier this morning outside that Bannister facility. There were about 25 people there. They moved a second action to the new weapons plant at 150 Highway and Botts Road. There were 65 people there. They did a die-in in honor and memory of those people who died from diseases related to some of the toxins at the plant. In fact, at the second location, they rolled out this big scroll of a list of toxins that were found at the first plant. Originally, the Department of Labor said there were 300 toxins there, and if you were exposed to any, you could be compensated. But if you were exposed to something else, you couldn't be. Later, that list got expanded to 900 and 1,500, and ultimately over 2,000 distinct toxins found on that old weapons plant at the Bannister Federal complex. So, and then five people got arrested in an act of civil disobedience, five of the 65. Henry Stover, who you heard speaking, along with Tom Fox and Sonny Hamrick, Lou Montanay, and Brian Terrell came all the way in from Molloy, Iowa, to get arrested. They did get an appearance ticket. Brian said his was for July 19th, and he is planning on being in Afghanistan then. So stay tuned, but that's what happened earlier today at the weapons plants here in Kansas City. We'll turn it over to Craig and Craig, but we might as well knock our first break out of the way.
On the next Radioactive Magazine, two interviews. First of all, we'll talk with representatives from the Clean Missouri campaign, followed by an interview of Jobs with Justice. That's Radioactive Magazine, Tuesday at 6 p.m.
What's that sound, you ask? It's the sound of one-time-use trash. People get bottled water because of hydration, convenience, and the claim of better taste and quality. Truth is, there's usually no difference between bottled and tap water. The healthier choice is to get a cool, reusable bottle made of lined aluminum, steel, glass, or special plastic that won't break off chemical bits like the plastic used in disposable bottles. Get healthy and keep your world from becoming a big junk pile. Disposables dead. Brought to you by J.C. Herman High School and 90.1 FM KKFI.
Hold the salt, please. On this current cast. Now that spring has arrived, salt-spreading plow trucks are a fading memory. But Todd Walter of the New York State Water Resources Institute says salt that washed off the roads stays in the soil for months.
It gets down to background levels again, sometimes as late as October, so we're really keeping the system juiced up for a long time.
Rain washes salt out of the soil and into streams, rivers, and lakes, where it harms crustaceans, amphibians such as salamanders and frogs, fish, plants, and more. There's even some concern that road salt might aid the spread of salt-tolerant invasive species. But there's a lot highway departments can do, like adding sand to the mixture to reduce the amount of salt used and still keep us safe. Current Cast is produced in partnership with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
Hey, welcome back to Eco Radio, and today I have on Craig Volland with me. We're going to be talking about CAFOs. And so the first thing, Craig, can you tell us what CAFO is and how the USDA defines that?
Well, it's actually the EPA defines it, but CAFOs are concentrated animal feeding operations. These are huge numbers of animals are crammed into small spaces, into buildings, into confinements. In fact, these engineering term for it is intensive confinement. If you go back to the journal articles when this was all invented about 30, 40 years ago, they were all bragging about the new technology of intensive confinement. And so it's gotten more and more intensive over the years. And in western Kansas is the second largest CAFO, hog CAFO in the country, which has 200,000 pigs in one location. And I know some people that only live 2 miles from it, and they never intended to be that close to it. So the CAFOs, the first CAFOs were really exterior cattle feedlots. There are now cattle feedlots with over 100,000 cows in them in western Kansas and elsewhere. Then the chickens came along about the same time, and there's hundreds of thousands of chickens in the same location. We'll talk about that a little bit later. And then finally, about 30 years ago, the hogs, which were used to be raised in pasture or in outdoor pens, are now crammed into in large numbers into these buildings, and the waste is sluiced out to these holes in the ground that they call lagoons.
Okay. And between those two types, between the feedlots and the inside type, does one have more environmental impact than the other?
Well, I've dealt with all of them over the years as the agriculture chair of the Kansas chapter of the Sierra Club. And I think going far and away, the worst are hog CAFOs. And that's primarily because of the odor, but also a lot of other pathogenic particles and bacteria and so on that come out of these barns. In order to keep these animals alive, they tend to have these powerful fans, or they'll die from the buildup of ammonia primarily, but hydrogen sulfide as well. But even the cattle feedlots, have in the last few years, scientists have measured antibiotic-resistant bacteria in the dust that blow off these exterior feedlots, because the cattle stir up the dust, and then there's usually heavy winds and out in western Kansas. So none of them are safe, including the chickens. And we'll talk about that a little bit later, because I just read a journal article about the incredible increase in bacteria during just the six-week cycle that chickens are grown. If you can believe that, that the chicks come in and as little chicks that you've seen, and 6 weeks later they're on their way to the slaughterhouse because they've been bred to have these incredibly fast growth rates in their breasts. So that toward the end, they can hardly walk. In fact, there's been a lot of photos or videos of them just literally just stuck to the ground.
Okay. And the difference in the cattle is not as bad as the hog farms. Is the cattle...
are outdoors.
They're outdoors, whereas the hogs are inside?
Right, and the chickens are inside.
Okay.
And they're crammed together. They're very densely... well, they're all pretty much crammed together, but the cattle aren't quite as... they have more room to walk around, but the trouble is where the biggest cattle feedlots are in southwest Kansas and the panhandle of Oklahoma and Texas is it's so hot in the summertime, and they don't provide any shade to these poor animals. And they're there for a couple of... They are on grass in the early part of their lives, and then they're trucked over to these... feedlots in the west to eat corn and soybeans and feed to fatten up very rapidly. But that's all done without shade.
And you said the CAFOs started approximately 30, 40 years ago.
Right.
At that time, were there benefits that were being advocated? Or any, did these companies show that there would be benefits to having CAFOs?
Well, they said that it would be cheaper to grow if you cram, if you essentially turn this into a factory. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are factory farms, and it was all about reducing the footprint. It was to reduce labor, because if you allow chickens to run around in a pasture, and it takes a little bit more labor and more land, but of course it's much healthier. When you cram all these animals into one place, they die off. When you put any mammal in close confinement, like humans, like they did in the concentration camps, the disease goes up and people die off. So what they did was to feed them antibiotics. And that's one of the worst things about CAFOs, is that they, starting in the 70s, began to put antibiotics in their feed and water. And now most people that are listening to this already know that it's greatly compromised the types of diseases or the ability to fight disease, because there's so much antibiotic-resistant bacteria out there now.
And so and that would be just because when humans are... ingesting the chickens, that's in their systems.
Or the pork. It's two things. One, antibiotic-resistant bacteria has been found in supermarket meat continuously for the last 10 or 15 years when they've been actually looking for it. You can find studies on it, Consumer Reports and other, where they actually go into grocery stores and find that there's antibiotic-resistant bacteria on this meat. which is why you have these big warning signs on the package about handling instructions, because you're bringing this into your house, into your kitchen, mm-hmm. and you have to be really very careful in handling it. And only in the last couple of years, after much hue and cry by the medical establishment, have they started to take some really timid steps to reduce the use of antibiotics. But it's still very widely used in CAFOs.
And would that problem be worse with the hog factories than it would be with outdoor feedlots?
I think so, yes, right. Okay.
And besides the antibiotics, are they still, I think I've seen in the past that they give them growth hormones too?
Some do, yeah, and I don't think they do that in chickens, but they do that in especially cattle and some pigs. But one thing I didn't mention, the other problem with antibiotic-resistant bacteria that are generated in these operations is they're also blown out of these buildings, because in order to keep the animals alive, they have to have strong fans. And so they have consistently found antibiotic-resistant bacteria downwind of these things, and have even linked them to disease problems in the neighborhood or in the within a few miles of these operations.
And so that would be kind of like through the air?
Yes, through the air pollution? Yeah, on particles.
Okay.
And also in the groundwater. They have found it in the groundwater from near these things.
So let's move to, let's talk specifically some about the chicken CAFOs.
Well, right. The main reason I'm here is to basically inform people, especially people who live in Kansas or know somebody who lives in Kansas, about what I think is, in my experience in the last 20 years of dealing with this, is the most egregious behavior on the part of the state government of Kansas has just about stripped away any defenses that rural landowners and even some what I would call exurban landowners have to protect their quality of life and their property values. And this all started, as many people already know because it was all over the news, started in September or even before that. A lot of secret meetings were held by the Kansas Department of Agriculture and representatives from the governor of Kansas with Tyson Foods and local politicians in Leavenworth County and also the city council of Tonganoxie. Tonganoxie is essentially a bedroom community of Kansas City. It's only about 25 miles to the west. And without telling anyone, they didn't even tell the representative and senator that represent the people of Tonganoxie. They secretly made deals with Tyson to bring in a slaughterhouse, and they put it upwind, just a mile from the city line. And then the Leavenworth commissioners, county commissioners, gave them $500 million in industrial revenue bonds, $500 million to reduce their costs. And so they had in, I think it was September 6th, because I remember when I was told about it, I couldn't believe it, but it was obvious it was true. They sprung it on the people of Tonganoxie in a big press release where the governor comes and the secretary of the KDA comes to Tonganoxie Community Center, and they have this, they invited all the press, and they were going to announce this huge slaughterhouse that will kill 65 million chickens a year. And the town of Tonganoxie, in all my experience of doing this stuff for all these years, I'd never seen such a spontaneous revolt on the part of the people of Tonganoxie. They were just went all over the place. They immediately started organizing. And what it really told me was just how clueless, utterly clueless, these big ag people in Kansas are. They really believed that the people of Tonganoxie would welcome a slaughterhouse on the just south of their downtown that would kill 65 million chickens with all the trucks and traffic and all the stuff involved in that, that they would all be celebrating. And it really is a big picture thing in the state of Kansas and perhaps elsewhere about the difference in cultural thinking and values of the people who believe in these big agricultural operations of all kinds, monocultures, growing hundreds of thousands of acres of corn, GMO corn and soybeans. And then you've got ordinary citizens who just want to live peacefully and healthily in rural areas. And so that was the beginning of a really sad story because the happy part was that Tonganoxie booted Tyson out of town. So then Tyson started going further west. They went down toward Wichita and down to Coffeyville looking for somebody that would host them. And then they also went up to the north, northeast Kansas, a town up there whose name escapes me all of a sudden. I think it's Cloud County, Concordia, up there. And so they started talking to their economic development people. And so that's where it stands now. But behind the scenes again, without telling anybody, Tyson comes in and had by now been looking through the regulations and saw that they needed further changes in the state regulations in order to allow a much more dense grouping of chicken production houses. There's basically two parts of it. You start out with your big slaughterhouse. Then you have to go out. If you're going to kill 65 million chickens a year, mm-hmm. you got to go out and produce 65 million chickens in all these barns. And the typical barn, I did an open records request and got a copy of the notes from one of these secret meetings, and they have found that they were going to put 29,000 chickens in every barn, and they were looking to put 4 to 6 barns at each site, and they were going to need 60 to 80 sites. So we're talking about a massive footprint over, and within 30 miles of the slaughterhouse. So if you did the math on that, you'll see there's going to be production barns everywhere, along with the trucks and so on. So Tyson then prevails upon the state legislature to change the rules that will allow, get this, 1/3 of 1 million chickens within just 1/4 mile, which is 1,320 feet, of a home. That's 1/3 of 1 million chickens can be placed within just 1/4 mile of a home and only 100 feet from a neighboring property line. The rules also allow 100,000 chickens within 100 feet of your home. That's because there's no setback for under 100,000 chickens, only the setback to the property line. So if your house is at 100 feet of your property line or on your property line, then you're going to be as little as 100 feet away from 100,000 chickens. Now, that is just irresponsible, but the legislator passed that. It was called Senate Bill 405. The governor signed it in March, I think. So that's what there is no zoning. In the process of passing Senate Bill 405, they voted down an amendment presented by the senator and representative that had been through the Tonganoxie process that would allow any county to vote whether they wanted the slaughterhouse and whether they wanted these production barns. But the legislature voted that down, took away from the people of Kansas the right to decide whether they wanted these massive operations in their neighborhood, took it away. And also, there's no zoning of agricultural property in Kansas. It's illegal to zone So for all practical purposes, the people of Kansas, particularly the rural landowners, are completely defenseless against these huge operations, in this case chickens. But then there's also going on another change to the rules, behind the scenes thing on hogs as well.
Now, with the idea that there's no zoning for agricultural property, was that one of the new laws?
No, that was always the case. Now, that would necessarily would not apply to the slaughterhouse. So it's still possible. There's nothing can be done about these production barns, mm-hmm. in my view. But before you get the production barns, you've got to get the slaughterhouse. There's no slaughterhouse. They're not going to produce all these chickens. Mm-hmm. So it's still possible for communities like Tonganoxie to defeat the slaughterhouse part of this and stop it from ever getting started. And the way to do that, about the only way to do that, in my opinion, is to prevail upon your elected officials not to provide subsidies. Because Tyson goes around the country. They just did this in Tennessee. For now, they've put on hold what's going on in Kansas, so they went to Tennessee and they're building a new slaughterhouse there. And what they always want and expect, now this is one of the richest corporations in America, Tyson, everybody knows that. And it's not just chickens, they raise cattle and hogs as well around the country. But they expect subsidies to come in your community. So that's what happened in Leavenworth County. They got $500 million worth of industrial revenue bonds. So if you can prevent the subsidy part of it, you've got a shot at, in my opinion, stopping these slaughterhouses. And that's what we'll be seeing. Now, underlying all this is a sense of desperation on the part of some rural communities. The further west you go in Kansas, or really the further northwest or southwest, you've got communities that feel like they have, in many instances, no choice but to accept these huge, what I call, animal factories or big ag operations, because many of their towns are full of empty storefronts and so on, because there used to be more people with diversified family farms. So what we really have here is, it was industrial agriculture that started 40, 50 years ago that has hollowed out rural America, and particularly rural Kansas. So now these folks out there who want to stay out there that have their ancestral home, they're thinking, well, you know, there's hardly any jobs out here, and so we'll just have to dig deeper. You know, you've heard, well, when you find yourself in a hole, the first thing you do is stop digging. Well, it was big ag that put them in the hole, and now they're saying, well, I guess I better keep digging to survive, because that's the problem. The more you put the more land, the children, the landowners don't want to live next to hog factories or big chicken things, so they leave. And so it's kind of a spiral what I would call a death spiral economically for these folks. So that's why in the long run, we've got to, and there's lots of folks doing this, is turn it around towards sustainable agriculture where families can go out and raise crops organically or sustainably and raise animals free range, because there's a growing market for that.
And by doing free range with the animals, you would eliminate a lot of the groundwater pollution that won't be so concentrated.
Right. When you concentrate the animals, when you have intensive confinement of animals, you also have intensive agglomeration of waste. Mm-hmm. Some of these lagoons are 11 acres in size. It's just like a huge lake, and it's nothing but hog manure that's breaking down and generating ammonia and odor, hydrogen sulfide, and in many cases seeping into the groundwater. So you concentrate the animals, you concentrate the waste. This was never a good idea. It was all about a factory mindset, or what I say, the application of industrial engineering principles to a living system. Let me say that again. The application of industrial engineering principles to a living system. Even the sound of that doesn't make sense, because it doesn't. In the long run, you've got to be with the ecology, not against it. You cannot run over it. And so that's essentially what we have going on in Kansas, and it's important that people in the urban areas support smaller farmers who are doing it right. And I also want to talk about another case that's going on with hogs, but when you get
before we get to that.
Yeah.
So in terms of the job issue, I'm guessing that some of these companies are promoting it as a job source.
Right.
Is there a way, if you're doing free-range cattle and hogs, et cetera, is there a way to do that without losing jobs and maybe even gain more jobs instead of through the factories?
Well, it has to do with what type of job you're talking about. It, like the slaughterhouse was supposed to employ 1,600 people, but these are the worst possible jobs. In fact, in most places, only they bring in immigrants, so the most desperate people to work in these places, which would then, the question is, well, isn't it racist? Is that part of the reason why people don't want these things? Well, I think it is, with a burden on the school system and that kind of thing. But the bigger question here is, why are these jobs so bad that only the world's most desperate people would want to work there? A better solution is to have more and more moderate-sized, diversified family farms. And they do produce, each farm won't produce 1,600 jobs, that's for sure. But they'll produce a few jobs, and the whole family will work there, multiple generations, and then there'll be a lot of them. I think it's possible. I do think it's possible that, or I think it's necessary, that the Americans as a whole quit eating so much meat. Because that's the other thing that happened 40, 50 years ago. They got sold a bill of goods that they need all this meat to be healthy. And that's just not true, as a lot of people know. And I'm not a vegetarian or vegan necessarily, but I'm saying we've all got to change our way of looking at meat as a food, that it's something really special, that you don't eat, you don't need it three times a day, maybe a few times a week. And then it will all fit together, in my opinion, with the capabilities of diversified family farms. Okay.
So we are going to take our second break now, and when we come back, we will talk about the hog farms, and we will take a couple phone calls at that time. So if you want to call in, the number is 816-931-5534. Again, that's 816-931-5534.
We're killing our plants and animals. Animals consider eating anything. All that trash can't be digested, causing death. This also goes for our plants. Piles of trash are ruining and killing them. In some animals that decompose, you would see all the trash that it consumed. The most we can do is educate people by having public speakers go to schools to educate on the topic and having litter laws where it's needed. With no litter, we would have a beautiful environment and live in healthy conditions. This is brought to you by J.C. Harmon High School and 90.1 FM KKFI.
KKFI is a non-commercial radio station. That means we receive financial support from our community marketing partners. These partners share information about their organizations or events while supporting KKFI's mission. Learn more at kkfi.org/marketing.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. The pygmy rabbit looks like it hopped off the pages of a storybook. A tiny gray-brown bunny, it weighs up to a pound.
So it comfortably fits in your two hands. Yeah, it's ridiculously cute.
Wildlife ecologist Evelyn LaRocia says pygmy rabbits live in desert areas of the Great Basin, where they eat sagebrush year-round. But as more frequent and severe wildfires sweep across the American West,
we're seeing this giant conversion of sagebrush ecosystem into cheatgrass at the lower elevation sites.
And warmer winters result in less snowpack, which the rabbits tunnel through to hide from predators as they look for sagebrush to eat. LaRussia studied the rabbits' distribution in the Great Basin and found that they had disappeared from many lower elevation sites. But at higher elevations, changing conditions have allowed pinyon pine and juniper trees to move into sagebrush habitats. The trees provide perches for hawks and other predators.
So pygmy rabbits are actually being sandwiched between two different processes that are both due to climate change here in the Great Basin.
And that puts their survival increasingly at risk. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Okay, welcome back and to Eco Radio, and we still have Craig Volland here, and we're going to go into talking some about the hog farms now.
Right. Along with the chicken situation, which demonstrates that the state of Kansas really doesn't care about the quality of life and the property rights and values of rural citizens, we have another incident going on where this fairly large hog producer in up in Norton and Phillips County, which is four counties east of Colorado line and along the Nebraska line, he wanted to expand his breeding facility by two-thirds. So, but in 1998, the state legislature had provided greater protections to the neighbors to these things if they got bigger than about 9,300 hogs. That's 9,300 hogs. If it got more than that, then they had to have a setback to the nearest house of 5,000 feet instead of 4,000 feet. And even more importantly, they had to be 500 feet away from surface water instead of 250 feet. Well, he was in a situation where he wanted to expand, but he was too close to the major creek that goes through those two counties. So he got together with the Kansas Livestock Association and their attorney, and they came up with a scheme where he would give half of his existing operation to his son and daughter-in-law through what they call an LLC, Limited Liability Corporation. And then they would say that they're two separate operations below that limit of 9,300 pigs. And KDHE bought it. They allowed it, even though it's in direct contradiction to the statutes from 20 years ago, which obviously the intent was to give greater protection to surface water and the neighbors. So when we found a Sierra Club found out about it, we started fighting it, as did some of the neighbors. But here is another example of where the Kansas Department of Health and Environment, and I'm sure they're acting on instructions from higher up, could have said, could quite easily have said, and had the authority to say, no, you can't do that, because in 1998, the legislature said that the when you get that big with that many pigs, then your neighbors deserve more protection, and so does our water supply. But they didn't. They went along with it. And if they get away with it, and we're appealing it, then this is going to be all over the state. Any existing hog producer who's kind of a medium-sized hog producer can double in size right where he is and not have to worry about the neighbors or anything. And so really the message here is that the state of Kansas, the existing government of Kansas, doesn't care about rural landowners. And, oh, the other thing about this creek, it's called Prairie Dog Creek, is it's already impaired. That's a term of art that's used under the Clean Water Act. It's impaired because it's already polluted. In this case, it's got excess phosphorus and it's low dissolved oxygen, which is typical when a creek is full of pollutants from agriculture. So it was already polluted when KDHE allowed this, and the two-thirds expansion of his breeding facility will allow, by the time they are grown out in what they call a nursery for the piglets, and then they're sent to what they call a finishing site. he will have added 90,000 hogs a load right along within a mile on either side of this creek. So this is in direct contradiction to the duty of KDHE to prevent further, this is in the law, to prevent further degradation of that creek. And so they could have said no, and they didn't. So now it's up to us to try to stop it.
And is the lawsuit or the administrative proceedings against KDHE to force them to enforce the law, or is it against the hog producer?
No, it's against KDHE.
Okay. And one of the problems, you mentioned algae blooms.
Right.
Can you tell us what that is?
Yeah, this Prairie Dog Creek actually flows about 12 miles to the northeast into Harlan County Lake, Nebraska. It is the second largest lake in Nebraska and is a very valuable resource for not only drinking water but recreation. It's a Corps of Engineers project. There's two fairly large towns next to it. And in the last couple of years, they've already had algae blooms, blue-green algae, which is toxic. So the lake cannot stand any more pollution. So this was, now, there are separate weak rules on CAFOs, which has a certain, what you might call legal fiction, that as long as they have a nutrient management plan, then it's assumed that they don't, none of that waste ever gets into the water body. But everybody knows that it does, because for one thing, KDHE isn't watching what they're doing. If they put the wastewater in when it's rainy or they have an accident, which happens all the time, wastewater does get in. So if you're going to add 90,000 pigs, you can be certain that that will add to the pollutant load.
And the wastewater, then, we talk about it's going into a lagoon first, is that correct?
Right, yeah.
And then it migrates from the lagoon into the groundwater.
In this particular case, it's particularly egregious because these lagoons are over what they call the alluvial aquifer, which is right along this creek, which means just about, 10, 15 feet underneath is groundwater. And these lagoons are not lined with plastic. They're just compacted soil. And so they're allowed to leak about 3 feet a year. So in 2-3 years, this waste is going to get down to this groundwater, which then flows along and into the creek. So that's what the legislature had in mind when they said, okay, if you're going to have that many more hogs, you got to get further away from it to get them off the alluvial aquifer. And so what KDHE did was allow them to put a new waste impoundment or lagoon right there next to that creek, only 200 feet, 50 feet away.
And I do want to remind listeners, of if you have a call, we probably have time for maybe one call, and the number is 816-931-5534. So the lagoon problem, you're saying it's allowed to leak 2 to 3 feet per year.
About 3 feet. It's pretty specific. It's a tenth of an inch a day, which works out to 3 feet a year.
So would I be assuming correctly, though, that if they have a major flooding problem, that those lagoons would leak even more than what they're allowed to?
Well, theoretically, they have a rule that it has to be beyond the floodplain. And there's they've got those, what do they call them, where they build up the dirt banks to prevent that. So mm-hmm. I'm not sure that's a – if it rained enough, it would probably do it. But that's not the issue. The other problem is that wastewater is then sprayed onto fields. Out of these lagoons, and in many instances, that's where you're going to get most of the waste going into the creek when it runs off, when they don't do it properly. And I repeat, there is nobody watching them.
All right. And we just have about 2 minutes left. Back when we were talking about chickens, and you said that waste, and I assume the waste would be the same from the hogs, is ammonia and some sulfur?
Well, it can be phosphorus, ammonia, nitrogen, really.
Is that from the manure or other stuff?
No, it's from the manure.
Okay.
Incidentally, it's well proven that a lot of that ammonia goes into the air from these lagoons, and if it's raining that day, it'll come right back down in the rain and into the creek that way as well. So that isn't even addressed in the regulations. So the final takeaway on this is that the state of Kansas is deliberately avoiding protecting rural landowners, and they need to be held accountable.
Okay. And if people want more information, I understand you wrote an article for the online newsletter.
Correct.
For the Kansas chapter, Sierra Club.
Yeah, you can go to the website, and there's the newsletter is now called Waypoints.
Okay. All right. So I want to thank you for being with us. You've been listening to Craig Vollen talking about CAFOs, and I'll turn it back over to Mike now.
Thank you, Craig. And just a couple of events to speak of. One's going on right now. It started at 6 o'clock, and it's a neighborhood litter pickup at 38th and Walnut. They were starting, and they were just going to concentrate on Walnut. So I imagine that's still going on right now. Then the other thing to tell you is Reverend Michael Dowd, who was a guest on our program a couple weeks ago, the eco-theologian and pro-science evolutionary evangelist, Reverend Michael Dowd, he when he was in town, spoke at the All Souls Forum. That forum will be broadcast on KKFI Wednesday night between 6 and 7 p.m. That's all I have. We're going to go out with This Week in Water. Do stay tuned for Fiesta Musical.
Opioids found in major U.S. waterway. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
Some journalists were barred last week from an EPA conference which discussed water contamination from compounds known as PFCs.
The chemicals can cause cancer and have been detected in water supplies around many military bases, likely due to their presence in firefighting foams.
On the first day of the event, reporters from the Associated Press, E&E News, and CNN were barred in the morning, while reporters from other publications were allowed in. The agency gave no explanation.
The AP reported that the guards blocked their journalist from the entrance, grabbed her by the shoulders, and removed her after she asked to speak with a public affairs spokesperson. In the afternoon, all reporters were allowed in, and an apology was issued.
But on the second day of the conference, no reporters were admitted because a spokesman said the purpose of the session was for state, tribal, and federal partners to discuss the path forward on the contaminants.
The conference was anticipated to be a positive move by the EPA about the widespread contamination, but the treatment of the press resulted in significant criticism.
These latest problems for the EPA follow reports, including here on H2 Radio, that the agency and the White House have buried a study on the same chemicals that says they are more dangerous at levels lower than EPA guidelines allow.
Shellfish in Puget Sound are being contaminated by drugs used by humans, including opioids, antidepressants, and diabetes medication.
CNN reports that the mussels are good indicators of pollutants because they store them in their tissues after filtering water for nutrients.
The Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife distributed clean mussels in the sound and extracted them months later. Of 18 locations, mussels at 3 were positive for trace amounts of oxycodone. While the levels weren't high, officials said it indicated a problem.
A biologist with the department said that the results tell her there's a lot of people taking oxycodone in the Puget Sound area.
But that's not all they found. The mussels also had 4 kinds of chemicals used in detergents and cleaning products. Known as surfactants, they have an effect on hormone systems of some animals, such as feminizing male fish and causing female fish to reproduce before they're ready.
Most of the contaminants are probably coming from treatment plants that receive water from toilets, houses, and hospitals, especially along shorelines nearest Seattle and other urban areas.
A shipwreck recently discovered off the Colombian coast may contain riches worth as much as $17 billion.
The remains of the ship were found in 2015 at a depth of 2,000 feet, but its cargo was not revealed. Axios reports that the treasure included gold, silver, emeralds, ceramics, and other artifacts.
The Spanish ship was sunk during a battle with the British in the War of the Spanish Succession, and its exact location is being kept a secret.
Rice is a crucial food for billions of people, but as the level of CO2 rises in the atmosphere, a new study shows that the grain is becoming less nutritious.
Researchers evaluated 18 types of rice to see what their responses would be if steps to curb emissions weren't implemented.
All of the rice varieties suffered. Protein, iron, and zinc levels declined. Certain B vitamins dropped significantly. Vitamin E was the only nutrient found to increase.
E&E News reports that other studies have reached similar conclusions about wheat, barley, and soy. The findings challenge climate deniers who argue that rising carbon levels are actually a positive factor for vegetation, including crops.
For instance, Representative Lamar Smith, a Republican from Texas, recently wrote an essay saying that more carbon dioxide will lead to increased plant growth, spurring better quality food and a greater volume.
Northern parts of India and Pakistan are suffering through a major heat wave. In the foothills of the Himalayas, Al Jazeera reports the town of Shimla, India, has run out of water. A water tanker supplies only one bucket of water per person.
Water tankers across parts of northern India are the only supply, with people being allowed no more than 5 liters a day, not quite a gallon and a half. In comparison, people in Cape Town, South Africa, have been allowed about 13 gallons during its drought.
As climate change occurs, India is experiencing ever hotter summers. Reservoir levels are at their lowest in more than a decade.
In Lahore, Pakistan, it was 110 Fahrenheit on Saturday, and the forecast is for more hot, dry weather.
And finally, Loch Ness is the largest freshwater body in the UK, 23 miles long and nearly 800 feet deep. But larger than its physical size is its mythical inhabitant, the Loch Ness Monster.
Nessie is supposed to be the sole survivor of a long-extinct aquatic dinosaur after a photograph from 1934 seemed to show a creature with a long neck emerging out of the dark, murky waters.
The picture launched a media frenzy, drawing thousands to the Scottish Highlands. And although the image was eventually proven to be a hoax, it hasn't stopped many from coming to the lake to this day, scanning the surface for a sign of life.
One of those visitors is Professor Neil Gemmell from New Zealand, and he plans to settle the mystery once and for all. He's leading a team of scientists in June to sample DNA in the famous loch.
Why? Because as he explains on his website, lochnesshunters.com, when creatures move about in water, they leave behind tiny fragments of their skin, feathers, scales, and urine, all of which carry genetic code.
By sampling the lake, his team will assemble a detailed list of the DNA in Loch Ness and compare it to other lochs.
In a statement, he said he'll be surprised if there's any DNA similar to an extinct dinosaur, but he's keeping an open mind.
He's more excited about discovering new species of life, particularly bacteria, as well as assessing the extent of invasive species recently seen in the loch.
The team expects to announce their findings next January.
That's it for this week in water. We'll see you next time.
This Week in Water is supported by the American Water Works Association, bringing together the best and brightest minds in the water sector at ACE 18. Learn more at awwa.org/ACE18.
Thanks for listening to Eco Radio KC on 90.1 FM KKFI. Kansas City Community Radio.